Trump's employer, potentially under threat in proposed legislation that gives the British government sweeping powers to clamp down on industrial action.
They say it's democratic when it's not democratic, so they're an affront to democracy, what they want on this bill. And it'll turn worker, they want to turn worker against worker, but it won't. It'll just cause confusion.
Mr. Speaker.
Formerly known as the Minimum Service Level Bill, voted on in Parliament Monday, the legislation enables the government to determine what a minimum level of service should be, with potential consequences for strikers and the unions that represent them.
The unions would face sequestration of their funds, which is obviously a serious, very serious step, and unions can't afford to go down that road. So it will effectively stop strike action in those parts of the economy, but it will also seek to scare people in other parts of the economy about what will happen to them should they take the decision to go on strike.
The freedom to form and join a union and to bargain collectively is one of the four international labour standards which the UK government has signed up to.
The UK is part of the ILO and signed up to all of its conventions. So the right to strike is really, as I said, fundamental human right. It's something that we should protect and be very aware of any legislation that seeks to restrict that. And I think, you know, I think internationally people will be concerned that here in the UK we're seeking to restrict that right.
Among the sectors impacted by the legislation, health, education, transport and fire services, all of which have staged several rounds of industrial action over pay and working conditions over the past year in the face of the UK's cost of living crisis.
Strikes became common during the Industrial Revolution. The UK has recognized the right to strike since at least 1906. And the protesters and union leaders here say they're not going to allow that right to be eroded or taken away. Saeed Poreza, London.
Specialists at the Republican Hospital in Donetsk have warned that the number of civilians who have been hospitalized is dramatically on the rise as Ukrainian armed forces are using more advanced NATO-supplied weapons. Almost 1,000 wounded have been treated since the beginning of 2023, the trauma center in Donetsk has reported. Specialists believe that the latest weapons sent by NATO countries are more advanced and lethal.
Until not long ago, only civilians living near the front line got wounded or killed. Now, following the new medium and long-range weapons provided by NATO to Ukraine, we have a much higher number of civilians being hospitalized. Look behind my back. Our hospital was targeted a few weeks ago.
Ukrainian armed formations have shelled hospitals a number of times over the past months. This hospital in central Donetsk, Voroshilovsky district, was hit by the artillery on April 28. That shelling caused 9 civilian casualties and severe damage to the building. On that occasion, among the dead civilians was also a child. 16 people also suffered injuries from the blast. Kyiv's forces fired high-explosive fragmentation missiles produced in Slovakia and transferred to Ukraine by NATO countries.
We have been denouncing the situation since 2015. We started with the European Court of Human Rights, but for inexplicable reasons, our case was dismissed. We tried then with the International Criminal Court, but they have never visited the Donbas, and this case was subsequently dismissed. We are now trying to bring it forward to the UN. Will human rights be finally protected here as well?
In fear of attacks on residential areas, kids have been forced to switch to remote learning throughout the whole school year, which, by the way, ends on Tuesday. Max Civili, Donetsk.
To commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And, of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayed Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement.
Our message to Israel is clear. If you think that you can launch a full-scale aggression in order to strike the equations of deterrence, which we made with our blood and armaments and strength, we will be ready to shower you with precise rockets, and you will witness black days unlike any other. The Israeli regime knows what we mean. We will use our precise rockets and all means available to us.
Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation. Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force with prospect of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Mariam Saleh, South Lebanon.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to a school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these puddles under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The Islamic Jihad resistance movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will be in the range of our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the joint operations room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
Just a couple of weeks ago, there were hundreds of refugees, mainly from African and Middle Eastern countries, sleeping on the streets outside the main asylum application centre in Brussels. Authorities have since cleared the area. The refugees have fled to neighbouring countries or have been crammed into emergency accommodation. A few remain in the area, but say their situation would be different if they came from Ukraine.
Only because we are Afghan, because we come from Syria, because we don't have the same color, because we don't have same culture, but it will be not the reason. Of course, a lot of people, we have the same mind. I can work, I can do everything.
When you come here from Ukraine, you get everything. Accommodation, food, work, everything. If you are from somewhere else, as a refugee, you do not get anything.
If you look, I cut also myself, because we don't feel good in camp.
Sometimes you want to die?
Yes, I want to die. You look at my hands, I cut it my hands too much with blades. I do it too much. Because what is it, life, eat and going to sleep?
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that EU nations are erecting borders on land and strengthening aggressive coast guard services at sea. The bloc pays billions of euro to outside countries to stop refugees from attempting to travel here, unless they are from Ukraine.
The EU slogan is, break the business model of smugglers. But what we do is feeding them. By blocking all pathways to protection.
There is a heavy far-right anti-refugee presence in the Parliament.
Europe needs a policy based on strong border control.
But many legislators are calling for a more civilized approach.
We already fund third countries like Libya, actually militias over there, to build camps, to host people there. And we see murder, we see rape, and we do not see a humane solution.
Key EU figures are currently in Hiroshima, Japan, for a G7 meeting. 350,000 people were living there when their closest ally, the United States, dropped its catastrophic atomic bomb in 1945. More support for Ukraine is high on the agenda. Critics say the last thing on their minds is providing refuge to those fleeing countries they helped destabilize in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
For the first time since massive regular protests began in January, the French government has held discussions with union leaders regarding a two-year hike to the retirement age. A notable problem with that long delay is that the age hike has already been forced into law via a decree by President Emmanuel Macron. Public opinion is overwhelmingly against the change, but the government is standing firm, even though anger is rising to threatening levels nationwide. The First Lady's nephew was recently beaten by protesters over the age hike. Over 60% of the country wants the Prime Minister fired, and neither Macron nor his ministers can appear in public without protesters noisily banging casserole pans.
There's enormous anger right now. Macron has destroyed our social services, given huge tax gifts to the rich, persecuted injustices while allowing the far right to demonstrate without barely any police presence. And this is not even a complete list. People just want to live normally. But the Macron era is one of sadness and poverty.
Unions say the country will not get back to normal unless the age hike is revoked. But France has seen massive anti-government unrest regularly for well over a decade, and usually over far-right austerity measures. France and the European Union continue to be hounded by accusations that they are anti-democratic, and the latest of many French presidential decrees has only further increased dissatisfaction and dissent.
There is growing realization that our major national policies are decided in Brussels, and that our president is a mere puppet. We're also subservient to Washington. Simply look at what we're doing in Ukraine for more proof. So there's no hope that we'll have democracy during the last 4 years of Macron's term. But if we don't get it in 2027, things will explode.
Union leaders left the closed-door meeting, calling it not useful and a one-way monologue.
The pension age hike has overshadowed other crises, such as record inflation, the arming of the unrest in Ukraine, and stagnant wages. But all of those remain unresolved flashpoints as well. Barring a surprise reversal from the government, unions are planning a 14th day of nationwide strikes next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is under pressure over his claims about the state of dentistry, as figures reveal that the number of active NHS dentists in England is at its lowest level in the past decade. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Morning Star has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak must drop any pretense that the National Health Service dentistry is on the road to recovery and finally deliver a meaningful rescue package, the British Dental Association, the BDA, has warned as the exodus from the service reaches new heights. A Freedom of Information request by the British Dental Association published on Tuesday, 23rd of May, reveals the lowest number of dentists available in a decade, in what the association called a reality check on months of misleading claims from the Prime Minister. The British Dental Association found that 23,577 dentists performed National Health Service work in the 2022-2023 financial year, down 695 on the previous year, and down over 1,100 on pre-pandemic numbers. It brings the workforce to levels not seen since 2012-2013. The figures are at odds with repeated claims from Rishi Sunak that recent reforms have boosted dentist numbers and arguments by ministers made to the current official inquiry into the crisis. Practices are struggling to fill vacancies, which means they face fines for not hitting their NHS contractual targets, according to the British Dental Association. It estimates that practices will have to pay back more than £400 million for not hitting their targets this year. The British Dental Association is calling for a new higher minimum unit of dental activity value, which it says could help stop dentists having to treat NHS patients at a loss. A minimum unit of dental activity value level of £23 was rolled out last October, lower than the current patient charge level of £25.80, and below the level required for most practices to cover their costs or attract new dentists into the profession, it said. The British Dental Association General Dentist Practice Committee Chairman Sean Charwood said, "Government needs to drop the spin, accept the facts and provide a rescue package to keep this service afloat. National Health Service dentistry is hemorrhaging talent and further tweaks to a broken system will not stem the flow." The Prime Minister once called for this budget to be ring-fenced. "We face an access crisis and with hundreds of millions set to be pulled away, funds must be put to work solving these problems." Ministers have a choice. They can help thousands of struggling practices fill their vacancies and see patients, or just pass by on the other side. Toothless in England, the campaign group demanding an NHS dentist for everyone in England said, "Children, adults and the elderly are left hopelessly abandoned and forgotten by the National Health Service and the government. Patients who contact us are often in extreme pain. They're getting increasingly angered by the lack of accessible dental care in England." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is under pressure over his claims about the state of dentistry, as figures reveal that the number of active NHS dentists in England is at its lowest level in the past decade, leaving millions of people struggling to get checkups or have toothaches fixed. The British Dental Association, the BDA, has warned of an exodus of dentists from the National Health Service, as it published figures showing that the workforce has been reduced to a level not seen since 2012-2013. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has repeatedly said that 500 extra dentists had been recorded as providing NHS services in the 2021-2022 financial year. A growing number of dental surgeries do little or no National Health Service-funded work, with the British Dental Association citing a £3 billion dental budget that has failed to keep pace with inflation and population growth over the past decade. A total of 23,577 dentists performed National Health Service work in the 2022-2023 financial year, down 695 on the previous year, and according to a response to a Freedom of Information request from the NHS Business Services Authority. That figure is more than 1,100 down on pre-pandemic numbers. The loss of dentists within the system has led to nearly 6 million adults trying and failing to get a National Health Service dentist appointment in the past 2 years, according to a recent analysis by the British Dental Association. The official figures on the NHS dentistry workforce appear to contradict the Prime Minister's claims that recent reforms have boosted the number of dentists. The British Dental Association said it thought the Prime Minister was relying on a rise in activity from dentists in the National Health Service in the financial year 2021-2022 that had naturally followed the end of the COVID lockdown. Sean Charwood, who chairs the British Dental Association's General Dental Practice Committee, said, "The government needs to drop the spin, to accept the facts and provide a rescue package to keep this service afloat. National Health Service dentistry is hemorrhaging talent and further tweaks to a broken system will not stem the flow." The Prime Minister once called for this budget to be ring-fenced. We face an access crisis, and with hundreds of millions set to be pulled away, funds must be put to work solving these problems. Ministers have a choice. They can help thousands of struggling practices fill their vacancies and see patients, or just pass by on the other side. The British Dental Association, the BDA, has been asking ministers to recycle money returned to the government by dentistry practices that have been unable to hit their contractual targets. It is estimated this money could exceed £400 million this year. The fall in workforce numbers highlighted in the figures is also said by the British Dental Association to underplay the full scale of lost capacity in National Health Service dentistry. A recent British Dental Association survey of dentists in England revealed that half of dentists, or 50.3%, had reduced the proportion of National Health Service work they did by more than a quarter since the start of the pandemic. And 74% of the dentists indicated they plan to reduce the amount of NHS work that they undertake in the year ahead. The National Health Service Business Services Authority did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said the latest figures might be lower than the previous year due to not all NHS dentists having submitted their data for the last financial year. The spokesperson said, "We're working to improve access to National Health Service dental care and have already increased the funding that practices receive for high-need patients to encourage dentists to provide more National Health Service treatments." The Department of Health spokesperson added, "We have also amended the guidelines so dental therapists and hygienists can deliver more treatment as well as making it easier to recruit dentists from overseas. And we will be setting out further measures to improve access shortly."
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Prime Minister has visited China in a visit that marks the enhancement of ties between the two countries, like in trade, set to reach the $200 billion mark. The Russian Prime Minister noted how the two countries have conducted the majority of transactions in national currencies, in line with de-dollarization. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the strengthening of China and Russia's ties, along with the two leaders' pledge of a new world order, devoid of Western dominance, flies in the face of U.S. opposition. First, let me introduce our guests. Holly Stanger, spokesman of La Ruth organization, joins us from Potsdam, Germany. Also joining us is Christopher Halali, who's a researcher and political analyst, who joins us from Hershire, Vermont. Welcome to you both. Let me start with you, Harley Schlanger. So you have this visit, which is going to set a record, it appears, in bilateral trade, as it was reported, potentially reaching $200 billion. So for Russia, that's great. For China, it's also a good deal. So much for the U.S. or the EU, warning China to help reduce revenues for Russia.
Well, the important thing is that the overall relationship has been strengthening for many, many years. It didn't just start in 2022 with the war in Ukraine. But this year in particular, in the first quarter of 2023, their joint trade is up 38.7%. So it's a big jump. And it represents two things. One, as you mentioned, the alliance against the hegemony of the unipolar order of the United States. The Russians and Chinese are working very closely together on that. But the second part of it is the commitment of the two countries to provide leadership in a shift to a new global financial architecture. And I should say a development architecture as opposed to financial. So the relationship is extremely strong. And the threat is not just Russia backing Russia and Ukraine. It's that China and Russia are showing the global south that you don't have to submit to this idea of a unipolar order.
Okay. We should note along those lines, Christopher Halali, that the statement coming from Russia that they said was significant was that 70% of the cross-border settlements between Russia and China are conducted in national currencies, the rubles and the yuan. Tell us how that is important when it comes to the whole notion of de-dollarizing their trade.
That's correct. Just a few years ago, trade was at a quarter in terms of national currency. And now you have the yuan and the ruble being used at upwards of 70% of transactions, with a commitment from both sides to make it 100% in the coming year plus. So what we are really seeing is we're seeing a resistance towards using the dollar and actually an overcoming of the dollar as the global reserve currency. And what actually this means is that, and this is from both sides, that using their own country's national currency is ultimately one of securing their sovereignty and their independence, not only political independence and sovereignty, but economic and financial independence and sovereignty. And so in that way, this is really part and parcel of a large movement away from U.S. Dollar hegemony, because we have a unipolar world after the Cold War, where the United States not only controls the political situation, but also the economic situation. Now we're seeing what Mishustin called a world multipolarization. So this development in the economic realm is also having political consequences. And that's why we're seeing, especially after the G7, all of these Western countries pushing arms and weaponry and increasing the heat in terms of war in Eastern Europe, and also increasing the pressure in East Asia. We're looking at South Korea and Taiwan and meddling in China's internal affairs and in its territorial waters. So this push towards economic independence, it also brings with it a political and military reaction from the West.
All right, I need to get your idea as to what the Chinese President Xi Jinping meant, Harley Schlanger, when he said that Beijing will give Moscow firm support. He assured the Russian leaders that China would be backing them on core issues of mutual interest, despite the pressure by the West. What core issues would you say China's talking about?
Well, I would say there are two primary issues. One is the West is trying to say that Xi Jinping's peace talks with Zelensky, that his attempt to get a negotiated settlement, is moving away from Russia, that the Chinese are nervous about the war. That's all Western lies and propaganda. The Chinese see the Russian fight in Ukraine as parallel to what they fear will come with the West attacking them via Taiwan, pushing for independence of Taiwan. So on the one side, you have this strategic partnership, which is, as your other guest said, this is a tectonic shift. But the fact that it's also economic shows that it's not merely against Western geopolitics, but it's toward creating a more just and fair international order, which you'll never get as long as the hegemons in the West are the ones calling the shots. So when Xi says this will be a lasting relationship, it's not just a partnership, it's a special relationship, that he's essentially affirming that there's no wiggle room that the West can use to try and turn Russia and China against each other, which of course is the old trick of Henry Kissinger, going back to the opening, the U.S. opening to China in 72-73, where Kissinger was trying to use China against Russia and Russia against China. That's not possible. That game is over. And the West is either going to have to adjust to it, or the West is going to be left on the outside. And by the West, I mean the U.S. and the British primarily, on the outside looking in, because in Europe, there are moves toward maintaining relations with China. And I think once the Ukraine war is over, the Europeans will mend their fences with the Russians.
Right. And how much is the U.S. at fault, Christopher Hilali, for Russia and China to get so close, as opposed to wanting to alienate Russia away from China?
I don't know if it's a question of fault, but ultimately we can see that that it further escalated the importance and the necessity of their close relationship. So China and Russia, as your guest rightly said, have been coming together for years. So this is nothing new. But let's say that it turned up the pressure to expedite a lot of those relations and a lot of and really building this unique bilateral relationship between Russia and China. Of course, they just celebrated 2019, 70 years of friendship. We remember that Stalin and Mao together in 49. But really what we're seeing today is we're seeing the result of U.S. hubris and a complete disaster of 20 plus years of the quote-unquote war on terror that has naturally brought Russia and China together. Don't forget, at the beginning of the war on terror, China and Russia wanted to work with the United States and its Western allies. But what ultimately happened was that, of course, for the military-industrial complex, you need to have other enemies as well. So Russia and China were kept out and constantly pushed, and NATO was expanded, and the pivot to the Pacific under Obama meant that the U.S. was also turning its eyes towards China more aggressively. So it naturally brought these two countries, which share a land border and share a common history going back centuries, it brought them together and fused them in a way that the United States might not necessarily have expected.
You know, this new world order is something that's talked about quite frequently now. It's kind of becoming the common terminology that's used, Harley Schlanger, when we talk about politics in one way or another. I want to go back to January when the Chinese President Xi Jinping visited Russia. And the statement that came, that was released by China, it said, quote, "They, the leaders, shared the view that this relationship has gone far beyond the bilateral scope and acquired critical importance for the global landscape and the future of humanity." Do you see it that way?
Xi Jinping has been talking for a long time about acting for the common interests of all humanity. And this idea of a win-win policy coheres completely with what the Russians are looking at. Let me just give an example. The BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, has become the most important, I would argue, economic and political coalition in the world. And the BRICS are attracting more and more countries that want to join, including Iran, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Algeria, Nigeria, Brazil, Argentina. And there's a reason for it, because the unipolar order has an insistence that all these countries give up sovereignty and accept the rule of the one policy coming from Washington, London, and Brussels. And much of the world is rebelling against it. And I think it's important, this idea of the strategic partnership goes back many, many years. In fact, in 1992, after the fall of the Soviet Union, they talked about a constructive partnership, then a strategic partnership. Then in 2013, when Xi and Putin met, they called it a special relationship. They've met 40 times since then. They're looking at what they can do to move the world away from this neo-colonial, neo-imperial model toward real justice for all nations. And that's why it's so attractive to the nations of the global south, most of whom have experience with European colonialism and see that Russia and China, for example, in Africa, Russia and China never had colonies in Africa. In fact, their work in Africa is to help nations. So this is why Xi is talking about this as such a big thing. And it does go back to 2013 when he announced the Belt and Road Initiative as an international interconnectivity along with the maritime Belt and Road that would be deployed to help all nations.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
If we were to ask Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, Christopher Hawley, who has said this quote that I'm going to read off to you right now, "We are working in solidarity on the formation of a more just and democratic multipolar world order, which should be based on the central role of the U.N., its Security Council, international law, the purposes and principles of the U.N. Charter," I am almost sure that he would answer that to be the U.S. But that's what Russia has said. Why has Anthony Blinken recently, the U.S. Secretary of State said that China is the most serious long-term threat to the world order?
Well, they see, don't forget, in the United States' myopic vision and worldview, they see China and Russia as strategic enemies because they ultimately reduce the power and the influence of the United States. So as your guest rightly pointed out, if we are moving beyond the neo-colonial and neo-imperial system, if imperialism and colonialism are based on exploitation, not only political exploitation, but economic exploitation, resources, which the United States needs to power its engine and to provide the cheap commodities for its economy, if they're moving, if China and Russia are trying to move away from that for a development model, bringing all the nations already up and elevating them, the United States has had an opportunity for how many years now? How many decades has the United States had the opportunity to give money and aid to countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America? But it hasn't done that. It's done the opposite. It has done coup d'etats, regime change wars, and it has plundered all the resources of the global south, of the global majority. Now you have China and Russia saying, we want a new political and economic situation. Of course, that's threatening for Blinken, because they're ultimately not interested in democracy, human rights, and, win-win diplomacy. They're interested in maintaining their power. That's why Russia and China are seen as strategic threats.
Okay, it's one thing for them to want that, right, Harley Schlanger? But it's another thing to make statements that are just so far from reality, you wonder whether they have really thought this through when they're making such public statements, like how Anthony Blinken has said Beijing's vision would move us away from the universal values that have sustained so much of the world's progress, or that when the U.S. President Joe Biden says that it has a conception of a bulwark of allies and partners committed to democracy, human rights, and the international rules-based order, when the U.S. is not doing that, but rather China is. You know, their statements are just, they just don't resonate the logic based on the actions that have been taken by the U.S.
Well, they're not logical, and they actually... In a real world, people look at the United States now and say, what's this gibberish coming from Blinken? Look at the G7 meeting. They issued a statement attacking use of economic coercion against other nations. And they said, that's what China's doing, that's what Russia's doing. That same day, Biden just signed another order for 300 new sanctions. The sanctions policy of the United States is seen by most of the world as economic coercion. The support for the International Monetary Fund conditionalities is seen by most of the world as economic coercion. And so when whatever Blinken says in the echo chamber of the NATO, Brussels, Washington, London consensus, they're all talking that same language. But outside of that bubble, people look at them and say, what's wrong with these guys? You know, just one other example, and this is something I picked up from some colleagues in Japan. People in Japan were wondering why you have a meeting in Hiroshima of the G7, which was the first nation attacked by an atomic bomb by the United States, when the world's so-called economic powers, the G7, are coming together to plan permanent warfare against Russia and China. Don't they see how hypocritical that is? And I don't know whether they're capable of understanding that or not, but the rest of the world looks at them as a bunch of dangerous fools.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm sure they don't see themselves that way, but that's sad to say that they are representing, in their eyes, the most civilized and richest economies of the entire world. So they are on the one hand, and then you have all the movements on the other hand, which I'm sure the U.S. and U.K. in particular are looking at, such as the BRICS grouping of nations, which was dismissed just as recent as years ago, where you have, as our guest there, Christopher Halali, Charlotte Schlanger, actually indicating how you have all these countries that want to join it. You have the de-dollarization move, which, like it or not, you know, that's happening at a rather rapid pace. And you have countries that are sick and tired of basically the U.S. sanctions, which the dollars is actually used as a weapon to enforce the sanctions. So why don't they seek, or the U.S. in particular, seek a way not to lose all these countries who are pivoting, many of them, towards the East, and of course, in particular, China?
You know, when you look at the United Nations, I just had a meeting last week with the Cuban ambassador at the U.N., and so when you look at the situation and you ask how can a small Caribbean country, for example, have so much international support, it's the complete bankruptcy of the West. Even a small country can do great things in terms of solidarity. And that's what you're seeing with Russia and China. You're seeing all these infrastructure projects, all of these agreements. See, China looks at other countries and says, we respect your internal affairs. We respect your political systems. We respect your culture and religious traditions. We won't meddle. Let's do win-win diplomacy, win-win economic development, and let's build you up. On the other hand, the United States and its allies go to countries and say, well, we don't like this in your political system. We don't like that in your religious and cultural systems and forms and traditions. So we're going to change you, and we're going to bring in all these NGOs. We're going to fund all these NGOs to begin to try to change who you are. China and Russia don't operate that way, right? They have tremendous respect for countries that they go in, and they want to work, learn from them, but they want to give them opportunities. The United States and its allies are not necessarily interested in that. They're interested in reshaping the world and the world order in their image. China and Russia do not want to reshape the world in their image. They want to reshape the world in a fair, just, and equitable way, right? That's that key idea of solidarity. But the United States and its allies are never about solidarity. It's always about who's going to do the best for me, who's going to give me the biggest return. They see the other countries of the world, right? Like they do Wall Street. What can they do for me? How much money can they make for me? And if they're not a good earner, so to speak, they are like the mafia. They're going to go and they're going to remove them from power, either with coup d'etats or sanctions. And these sanctions are siege warfare. This is economic warfare. It's even worse than coercion. But that's what the United States and its allies do. But they only see themselves as being the ones who are the arbiters of what's right and what's wrong. Remember the key words from the late Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, who said that after World War II, the United States would have gone on trial for the use of atomic bombs and for its war crimes in bombing all these Japanese cities and German cities with napalm and incendiary weapons that burned and destroyed most of these cities and burned the population alive. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Because they were in power and because they had become at that time the Soviet Union, the United States, who is going to judge the United States for its war crimes? And who's going to judge the United States for its war crimes in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, in Yemen, its support for the Zionist regime against the Palestinians, its attempts to overthrow Venezuela, Iran, Cuba? No one. Why? Because the United States sees itself as the arbiter of what is justice and what is law and what is right. They don't want to have other countries have that same say and opportunity.
Well, that sounds great. We should end the program on that, but we still have time because what you said is very important. Cornish Langer, you mentioned something that's really important here, and I'm wondering how this is actually working out right now when it comes to the relationship between the EU and the United States. When you mentioned how the EU is not going to decouple, if I may use that word, from China, once this war is over, they're going to reestablish perhaps a warmer relationship with China. That was really evident when the French President Emmanuel Macron visited China, and he also had EU's von der Leyen, the President of the European Commission, who also went along with the French President. I mean, we could look at the entourage and how many airplanes was there with business delegations from France. Doesn't the U.S. see that? And what is going on there between the two? Because I'm sure the U.S. is probably feeling a bit uneasy when it comes to the way that Europe does view China.
Well, the U.S. is very uneasy about it. And you can see that in the reaction to Macron, who really didn't go too far out on a limb. But he did say we shouldn't cut off relations with China. We shouldn't decouple economically. Von der Leyen went there with a completely different mission. And even worse was this little nutcase we have, the green nutcase, who's the foreign minister for Germany, Annalena Baerbock, who went out there and lectured the Chinese about human rights violations. Now, what's happening is that you have a lot of people in Europe who are fed up with this idea of fighting a war in Europe against Russia. Now, the prime case is the Nord Sea pipeline. The fact that the U.S. most likely was the culprit that blew it up. I think Seymour Hersh is absolutely right on that. What does the German government do? Nothing. They don't even do an investigation. So the European governments are literally vassals of the United States. They talk about sovereignty and democracy, but who elected King Charles? Who elected Rishi Sunak? You have these governments that are minority coalitions imposing horrific policies against their populations to defend this Anglo-American war against Russia. So I think there's a great deal of concern in Washington about what's going to happen in Europe. And I see in Germany a potential. It's not realized yet because the Germans are so passive and so used to being under the thumb of NATO and initially protected by NATO, but now controlled by NATO. But the younger population is not so happy with that. And I think it's important for the rest of the world to reach out to the citizens, and even in the United States, and say to them, look, we don't want to destroy you. We want to work with you. Why don't you want to work and help?